This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. Today, episode 10, Fight Like a Girl, Strong Female Characters in Speculative Fiction.
So I think we're going to both start off by saying how much we absolutely loathe the term strong female character.
Yeah, or strong woman.
Yes.
Or strong girl. Part of the problem is the connotation suggests that if you have to put the qualifier strong in front of something, you're implying that everything else of that type is in fact weak.
And I think, well, it isn't just that. It's that in order to establish a positive thing, you have to add strong female character. So you could say a female character, but the moment you put strong female characters, that's meant to imply that it's better.
Yeah.
Which isn't very good, because as Jules, you've said in previous episodes, you never have a strong male character. That's not a descriptive that's used for a main male character. But if you have a main female character, they always want to add strong, because somehow the idea of just having a female character means that we're not going to understand that they could be strong unless it's explicitly stated, because that is not the automatic response.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is something I submitted a short story to a science fiction magazine a couple of years ago now, and they came back to me with a rejection, a really lovely rejection, with a page and a half of feedback saying how much they liked the story and that it just didn't fit. Which was, you know, quite nice. But one of the things that I've always remembered about that, and I am sorry because they obviously went to a lot of effort giving me this feedback, was, we love your strong female character. And that's the bit that stuck in my head. And it was both flattering and infuriating at the same time.
Yeah. Now, I think the problem is that you can use strong in a different sense. And this is why I don't completely reject the term of strong female character. And that's that very often, female characters are written badly because they're not written as characters, they're written as a kind of object in order to further man pain.
The sexy lamp, isn't it?
Yeah, the sexy lamp, which is that the sexy lamp test is if you can take a story and replace the female character with the sexy lamp and the story is still able to continue coherently. And very often, I would then consider those characters to be weak female characters. Not necessarily because of any qualities that they themselves possess, but because they are written weakly. So when I say strong female character, what I mean is a strongly written female character, and is in no way a reference to the quality that they possess as a character. So they could be a mercenary, they could be a weeping widow, they could be anything. But if they're written well, then I consider them to be a strong female character. Just in the same way that if a male character is written well, I consider him to be a strong male character. Because you would just call them a strong character.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's worth defining at this point of view, or rather looking at a definition at this point of view, so that we're clear on a few things. The term Mary Sue is quite often used as a sort of caveat to say that the author has put themselves in the book in a very two-dimensional way as the main character, and it's used as almost synonymous with a weak female character, that, you know, the author's sort of doing a wish fulfillment type thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas, in fact, the term Mary Sue originated from comic books, and a Mary Sue was when they thought, oh, actually, we kind of want to go in a different direction with this, but we haven't set it up very well. So they'd send in this over-perfected female character who twisted the plot and made everything about her, and it helped send things off in the correct direction for the next bit of the story they wanted to tell. But it was massively unpopular because nobody really likes a two-dimensional character, even if they don't understand that's what they're rejecting in that part of the story.
Yeah. The thing is that Mary Sue has obviously been twisted as time goes by, and as you pointed out, Jules, there is one understanding of the word, regardless of whether it was the original, there is now an understanding of the word, which is a Mary Sue is a self-insert, and a real place where we see Mary Sues most prominently is in fan fiction. because a lot of fan fiction does involve certain wish fulfillment where the audience want to insert themselves into the story, and so they create an equivalent character to live vicariously through in a fan fiction. And I personally don't see why there's anything wrong with that. No. Because I think that in the day-to-day, we do that anyway. You know, we insert ourselves into stories constantly in our own heads, and just because you're putting it to paper doesn't make you any more narcissistic. It just means that it's important to you. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. But I think a lot of people got annoyed because people would create these Mary Sues, and then they would make them perfect. And so this huge stigma came out. And I was, you know, I remember when I was a little bit younger, I wrote Mary Sues as well, and then I was all against Mary Sues. And then someone pointed out something interesting to me, and they described a character to me, and they asked me whether it was a Mary Sue. And I'm going to do the same thing with you, Jules. I'm going to describe this character to you, okay? So you've got this character. They are tragically orphaned, okay?
Yeah.
So lost both of their parents. This trauma has basically prompted them to improve themselves, and they decide to that they want to save other people from having to face that fate. So they learn how to fight, and they turn out to be really, really good at it. And not only are they exceptionally good at fighting, they're also really, really, really smart. Like, incredibly smart, very good at building stuff, very good at putting things together, very good at hunting, you know, the ultimate kind of mercenary. Except that they don't do this for money. They do it, it's all about the justice. So they all do it for justice. And then they grow up, and they live this double life, you know, in sort of by day. They're kind of very much admired by the community. They become a bit of a public figure. She's an extremely attractive, you know, person. Everybody's very much, people fall in love with her. They can't help it. She's very easy to talk to. She's a little bit mysterious, but she's very charming, and she has a constant string of boyfriends who are very invested in her. But by night, she is this real kind of force against evil. And she, you know, she has a few people who help her out, and, you know, some of them are better trained than her, and yet, but she's the main element, and she always kicks ass, and she always gets out, and everyone's kind of afraid of her. She also ends up having quite a few affairs with her fellow superheroes and stuff like that. But she's definitely the smartest among them, and the better fighter, and the most attractive. So, if I presented that character to you, what would you say?
That she probably needs a few flaws to be a fully rounded character.
Yeah, okay, all right. Okay, so let's say that maybe she has a little bit of a sort of... Maybe she has a little bit of an anger management issue. What is that? Should we say... Okay, she gets a little bit angry sometimes.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, okay. So that got presented to me, and I said, really? So she's rich, she's good looking, she's charming, she's got all the love interests, she's the best fighter, she's also the smartest person. That sounds like a Mary Sue to me, like a real Mary Sue. You got to admit it, Jules, that sounds like a Mary Sue.
If we're going with the more modern understanding of Mary Sue, as in a stand-in cardboard cutout for the author, possibly.
Yeah. Do you know who I've just described?
I don't know. It started to sound like Harry Potter at one point.
Well, actually, it's Batman.
Is it really? Yeah, I was thinking halfway through, if you flipped the gender, we wouldn't be having this conversation, would
exactly.
we?
Exactly. We wouldn't be having this conversation because the character I just described was Batman.
Yeah.
He's the good-looking, rich, traumatized childhood, charming but fierce. He's got all of these qualities, and I think that is incredibly telling. And I think that's a large part of what our subject is today, is that the qualities which are forgiven in a male, you don't get male Mary Sues. You kind of do sometimes, but it's not as big of a thing. So,
yeah, it's a more forgivable crime if it's an author stand-in, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, from the original terminology, it's impossible to have a main character who's a Mary Sue, because you can't twist the plot to suit a main character if they're already the main character.
Exactly. Because, as you say,
it's already all about them.
Don't need to twist anything. Already there. But yeah, so Mary Sues are a bit of a bugbear for me, because I think that actually the real crime that a Mary Sue, in the modern understanding of the word, suffers is the fact that they're female.
As you say, I mean, it's certainly more forgivable thing if you flip it over and it's a male character rather than a female one.
We're willing to sort of accept that. We're willing to go, yeah, okay.
Going back to the use of the word strong, I think what most people probably mean when they're saying strong female character is this is a female character that's written and is displaying agency. She pushes on the plot more than it pushes on her. If you took her out of the story, you could not have the story.
Yeah.
And there are, unfortunately, as you say, badly written female characters. There are badly written male characters as well. But badly written female characters are less, perhaps, forgiven. And you could take them out of the story, and even if they're quite key characters, the story would continue. And if a story will continue without the character, then do you need the character? That is the question.
And I think it's the fact that we're more willing to get rid of female characters, obsolete female characters, than we are to get rid of male characters. And I think this also brings us on to a very important topic, which is the endless, ceaseless murdering of women in fiction.
The girls in refrigerators.
Yeah.
Basically.
And, okay, I concede that there is a certain element of the fact that, yeah, women are more prone, I don't know, I can't be sure of the statistics, so maybe I'm lying, but there is a higher violence rate, murder rate against women than there is of men. Am I correct? I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in that. I could be entirely
wrong. Correct in generally, and certainly you have to bear in mind it's what's reported, that's what the statistics are based on. But yeah, murder, rapes and sexual assaults, there's a higher statistic against women, certainly in this country. However, reports of violence against a person, there's actually a higher statistic against men, just general violence.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. But the trope of killing all the female, the female characters we consider to be obsolete is kind of a shame, because the decision tends to be rather than flesh out the characters, you should kill them. And whilst I agree that you should get rid of obsolete characters who aren't good for the narrative, at the same time it's about finding the balance between why did you even create that character. That there's got to be a reason for the death, and it's got to be more than shock value. And you've also got to question yourself in that, what could that character have added if I didn't kill them?
Yeah.
What could that character have given? Do they have a higher impact in their death? Or could they have, if I'd actually written them a little bit better, could they have had a higher sort of impact in life?
Absolutely. I mean, along with the sexy lamp, you also have the girlfriend or love interest or hopeful love interest being tragically murdered before they can get together, or just as they're happiest, and being found in horrible circumstances, and that's what really sets the hero, if you like, off on his quest.
Yeah.
Female characters cannot just be the reason, the catalyst. And if they are the catalyst, it needs to be done properly. It can't just be, well, I happened to find my girlfriend chopped up in a refrigerator, because I'm not the only one getting bored of that, am I?
No, you're absolutely not the only one getting bored with that. And well, okay, this is going on a very slight tangent. It is female characters. And have you heard of the bury your gaze trope?
No, I don't think so. I might have heard it, but not under that term.
Yeah, well, the bury your gaze trope is the senseless, repetitive murder of bisexual and gay women in fiction. And so it's such a common thing that they've got their own hashtag, bury your gay. And this has happened quite recently. I don't watch The 100, but there was a female character in The 100. These two girls, I think one was gay and the other was a bisexual. They just got together, and then one of them died. Lexa, I believe her name was. She was killed. The lesbian character in The Walking Dead was then killed within the same few weeks. Charlie in Supernatural, lesbian, killed, murdered, and then put into a bathtub. And the list goes on. The list is, I mean, there was actually a few lesbian characters in Buffy, I think, as well, who were killed. The point is that the list is never ending. And even though, I mean, the amount of gay characters or LGBT characters who get seen on who get into shows, of the females who get into that, the majority are murdered.
Yeah, I mean, that's whether it's intentional or not, that's not great subtext, is it?
No, but it's the combination of the fact that we go, look, we're inclusive, we've included a gay character, but then we're going to get rid of that gay character because they're not quite important enough to keep. You know, they were just there to tick a box. And it's the fact you've got the killer gay character and killer woman. You throw them together and you've got no chance. These characters have no chance. And how does that reflect on real life people who see themselves represented on TV for the first time and then repeatedly have to watch these characters get murdered over and over and over again? And it's an affront against women, and it's an affront against the LGBT plus community. And it's something about women liking other women, and this is something that we need to explore.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
A very popular thing is that female characters are either sort of standardized in two way, in that they either consider themselves to be not like the other girls, which somehow makes them superior, and they don't get on with the other girls. All the other female characters, in order to make this main female character stand out, are incredibly girlish, and then this main female character has all the qualities which one would consider traditionally male.
Yes.
Therefore, they are better than these silly little girls. And then the other one is that all the female characters just automatically get along because all women are the...
Yeah, absolutely.
That's incredibly lazy writing.
Yes, it really is lazy writing. Part of the idea of this particular podcast was I saw a Tumblr post by At The Book File, which is The Book Mariner. And I did actually try and see if she minded me using her list. So I'm hoping that she doesn't, because I've taken a few points from it. I thought she made some good points. And it's things that people would like to see more of in speculative fiction, particularly. For example, an all-girl cast. So all girl teams, all girls. Less self-sacrificing martyr types.
This is true.
Mothers that do more than parent and cook.
Anime mothers.
Yep.
Who parent, cook, are lovely and then die.
And mothers and daughters who don't just hate each other. Girl characters who are good at maths and science. Actually, I've come across quite a lot of those, so that might be a perhaps you.
Yeah, but when they are they? Is it that they're girl characters who are good at maths and science, except they're total nerds?
Both. There are some where it's just incidental. I happen to like maths and I'm really good at it. And there are some that are, I understand physics, so I must be really, really clever. And it clearly is a contrivance of some kind.
Well, I remember that, okay, there's only one instance I've ever seen. So yeah, that's Lydia Martin. She's the popular girl. And while she does definitely possess some of the traits of the popular girl in school, the slightly preppy popular girl, she's incredibly clever. And she's very good at the sciences. She's very good at maths, but she proves to also be quite adept at chemistry as well. And this is quite understated. It's just something she is, and it's not a definitive part of what she is, of what she can do, but it's just a quality that she possesses. And to be honest, as you mentioned, the female characters in Teen Wolf are very good altogether. And Allison was another one, and Kira, who's introduced later. They're all quite individual. So I would definitely consider them to be well-written, strong female characters, in that they all have their own story, and they all have their own qualities, and they interact with each other in varying ways, and their friendships are realistic.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I've come across other examples in books. There are some where it's clearly a contrivance. Like, I don't know if you've ever read any of the Morganville vampire books, but they are just basically it's episodic sort of vampire fiction with 16-year-old Claire going off to university really early because she understands physics. And it is a contrivance just to get a 16-year-old girl into a situation where there can be lots of adult activity happening around her. And vampires, obviously.
Naturally, because what else do you find in college?
But it's kind of like, well, she understands physics and maths and chemistry, therefore she's intelligent. But it never goes into any detail about any of it, which doesn't really wash with me, I'm afraid. Because it's like, okay, she likes physics, so you can at least go into some basic bits and pieces about physics.
People who like stuff, that tends to sort of be reflected in the day-to-day, in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you have Caladri of Mindelin, who's another Tamora Pierce creation. But her interest is she's another one who wants to be a knight, and she's training at it. But she happens to be naturally very good at maths, and she is just really good. It's just one thing that she likes doing. She can work out really complicated equations and things in her head.
Mm-hmm.
But it's convincing. It's not all she thinks about, but it's something she likes.
Yeah.
I think that's perhaps a female character distinction, whereby people ask for a lot of these things, but at the same time, they don't necessarily want these characters to be defined by them. They don't want them to be defined by their race, their creed, their colour, you know, their interest necessarily. They don't want them to be defined by a romantic plot necessarily either.
We don't want, in life, we don't want to be defined by any single one quality.
No, absolutely.
That we possess, willingly or not, you know. I wouldn't consider being a woman a quality, because not a quality, the gender. This makes me, talking about sort of character Claire, it makes me think about 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
I think one of the main objections, and people are probably going to laugh, one of the main objections I had about 50 Shades of Grey was the fact that she didn't have an email.
Yeah, that was so totally unbelievable. Why did she need an email address set up for her?
And that really confused me, because unless she was one of the, you know, like strict Baptist, one of these, I don't know what they're called, you know, they live in their little, sort of, they're not allowed technology, which obviously she wasn't. She went through college. You literally have an email assigned to you.
Yeah, did she
when you go through any formal education.
Did she not use it? I mean, maybe he wanted a private email where he only spoke to her. Maybe that was it. But it was still very, very weird. And it was also very weird the way that E.L. James throws around characters like Tessa the D'Urbervilles and Jane Eyre, and clearly doesn't understand them at all. I'll be upfront here. I do actually like Twilight. I think it's good escapism. And I disagree with what seems to be a general opinion that Bella isn't actually any sort of character at all and is quite flimsy. I do think she has agency. I think she makes terrible decisions with that agency, but I do think she's the author of her own destiny.
I think the real problem with Twilight was that Twilight crumpled under its own popularity.
Yes.
In that people started to analyse it as literary fiction, which it absolutely was not, and it was never meant to be literary fiction.
No.
It's commercial fiction, plain and simple. It's sit down on the beach, read this in one go, simple reading. The story was interesting, if a little bit silly at times, but that didn't matter. For what it was good.
It was just escapism.
It was sheer escapism, and it was meant to be easy escapism. You weren't necessarily meant to get anything sort of out of it. But the problem was, because it became so popular, people started to analyse it as if this was, you know, as if they expected more out of something which had already completed its task. It was just meant to be enjoyable. It wasn't meant to actually offer any form of sustenance. Now, you consider Bella to be not a flimsy female character. I'm on and off about it. When I first read, well, my brother pointed something out to me, which is that Bella is actually quite an empty character. Now, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. Bella was designed for the reader to be able to insert themselves into the character of Bella and live through her. She's a vicarious character. She's a little bit of a Mary Sue, I guess, in that sense. Again, modern understanding of Mary Sue. She's a self-insert. And so when I read Twilight, I also felt that she was more complicated then certain people gave credit. And my brother pointed out, they said, that's because you're seeing, you're living through her, and you probably consider yourself to be quite, you don't consider yourself to be two-dimensional.
That's actually a very popular, particularly male opinion. I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong, I just don't think it's the entirety of the story.
I do certainly feel that on her own, Bella Swan doesn't necessarily have a character, a very strong character, and in that we do insert ourselves a lot into her because that's how she's designed, and that's a very common thing that you see in commercial fiction. We want to be able to insert ourselves into the story and just go through it very easily. We don't want overly complicated characters because that's not what you want when you're sort of doing some light reading on the beach. So I think, again, I praise Twilight for what it is. Twilight is fantastic commercial fiction, is very good. But Bella herself as a character on her own, as a literary character, isn't that strong. And I think the way that we can especially see that is the fact that when Kristen Stewart, is that her name? Was given Bella, there was no actual substance to Bella on her own as her own entity. And that was very much reflected in the films, because I don't think that Kristen Stewart is a bad actress. She's proven not to be a bad actress.
No.
It's just that Bella on her own is already a kind of half person. Bella is a glove that we kind of put on, and a glove is not a hand. A glove needs to be worn.
I'm going to disagree very slightly, because you've probably not read Reimagining of Twilight, where she Maya changes the genders of all her characters apart from the parents.
No, yeah. And which I would actually quite like to read.
Yeah, it's good fun, and I think it's quite a ballsy decision. That's something that's worth examining in more detail in perhaps another episode. Not that on its own, but the whole sort of where do your characters fit in. It wouldn't have worked if there hadn't been substance to the characters. So I think the thing is that a lot of people find Bella a bit wet. It's not that she's flimsy, it's just a case of, well, I wouldn't act like that. And the people who find her flimsy, or find her a bit more like a glove puppet, as you said, there is an element to that, but I think that there's more to it. She's much more selfless than probably anybody would be. She's also much more incredibly sort of stupid and selfish in that very sort of Romeo and Juliet type way, where there's one true love and everything in the universe then revolves around it.
Yeah, but I think that there is an element of it, that she is a little bit too selfless at times. Again, you're right. I mean, I still withhold that as a character on her own, she doesn't have that much to her. But I'm willing to concede that my judgment may be biased. I'm willing to concede that that is just my opinion. And I don't think it's fair to laugh or mock people who get more out of it than others, because it's not for me to judge how good of a book you think it is. All I can judge is how good of a book I think it is. And I think for a commercial fiction, it's good. And as a character, she's not great, but she serves the purpose that she's supposed to.
Absolutely. So. And ultimately, the big test is, could you have the story without her? Well, if you take her out of the story ceases to exist. So
This is true.
She's not a lamp.
She isn't a lamp. She isn't a lamp. But she is a damsel quite a lot of the time.
She is
and
a
even
damsel.
When she's the hero, she's still the damsel.
Yeah, and I think that's a very fair point. If it is a story of the superpowered versus the non-superpowered and trying to keep up all that time, and then finally you get made superpowered, so you know you can be the hero. I'm sorry, but I'd have been tearing up rival vampires left, right, and centre if that was me. It would not be. Let's have a little chat about it and let them go away to come back and slaughter you another day.
Yeah, but anyway. The point is that Twilight had its failings as a series, but I think it did well for what it was, and it's not actually necessarily the right subject to be talking about when it comes to female characters. Mm. I think the spin-off of 50 Shades, as we've already discussed, is absolutely the right...
Yeah, we could call that speculative fiction because it's so unlikely that...
Yeah, I guess it isn't speculative fiction necessarily, but it's fan fiction of speculative fiction, so I...
I'm sorry, I feel there's something really dishonest about 50 Shades of Grey and its sequels, because clearly It's fan fiction written based on Twilight and without any real understanding of how to write or how to characterise, and then the names were just changed and it was sold. And I find that a little bit distasteful, I have to be honest.
I agree. There's a lot of circumstances. Well, I mean, we could discuss that differently, sort of. That's not our topic today. But yeah, there was some dishonesty. But I think the thing that got me the most angry about 50 Shades was the erroneous representation of BDMS relationships.
Yep.
And was the fact that she didn't have an email. which really... That was a deal breaker for me, because I'm like, where has this woman been?
she is some sort of idiot savant, isn't she?
She is. Like, she shouldn't be alive anymore.
And yet, look at what we're doing. We're looking at that, and instead of criticising the hideous male character, we're blaming the female character for being what she is.
Well, there's...
I mean, she's awful. She's really badly written, but we are still doing it.
Yeah, but I think I guess that there's some point, which is that hideous as Christian Grey may be, he's still a believable character.
I have to agree to disagree.
I think
more substance. I'll give you that.
The way that he's horrible, the kind of person he is, he has a lot of qualities which are the qualities of a psychopath or a total sociopath. He's charming. Charming people often actually do find themselves in high positions of power. He is an abused victim and he's a bit messed up in the head. I find him to be more believable than her.
Oh yeah.
And again, now I really don't like him as a character. I pity her.
I mean, you could replace Anna with a lamp, I think. That story could happen with pretty much any sort of substituted two-dimensional female character.
We need to emphasise that we're not blaming the character. We are blaming the shoddy writing.
Yeah.
it's nothing to do with the character. It is not, because there are people out there who will say, well, actually, I'm a little bit like that, and who will recognise themselves in these characters. It's not about that. It is about how she was written. And for the character that she could have been, that she was supposed to have been, it was just wrong. It wasn't good storytelling, and it wasn't, because even if people go, oh, yeah, well, I'm like that, you're not a two-dimensional human being. No one is two-dimensional. Even if on the surface you appear to be, there is so much more going on, but there was nothing more going on inside of her. Everything we saw was what we got.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was... It was just surface and there was nothing else.
Now, I feel like we should probably look at superheroes.
Yeah, definitely.
And we're talking about that list you mentioned, the all-female cast. We mentioned briefly in a previous episode about Jessica Jones and how Jessica Jones was put together. Now, Jessica Jones has it's not all-female. It's almost an all-female cast in that there are female characters playing most of the significant secondary characters. If Jessica is the main character, the main villain is Kilgrave, played by David Tennant. But otherwise, the haughty lawyer is a woman, the secretary is a woman.
And they're involved. I think that's actually quite a good point to make as well, the fact that...
Yeah, the the lawyer who's having an affair with her secretary, they're all women on her wife. It's almost an all-female cast. And interesting, and quite nicely, is that it's almost an all-female cast, and the secondary male characters are, I think, they're all black, actually, or they're all people of colour.
Yeah.
Except for Kilgrave, that's not true. There is another white guy, but he's kind of eye candy, and then sort of something weird happens with him. And then there's Kilgrave, who's the bad guy, who's white. But it was a nice casting choice and very interesting. And kind of, I think the most shocking fact was at moments you wouldn't notice it at all because the characters were just, the actors were so fantastic in their characters. But there was a kind of moment where you go, wow, actually, I'm seeing a lot of women on screen, and we're so trained to see majority male that even having 50-50 makes us feel like there's an overload of women, which is kind of peculiar.
Yeah.
So there's that. But then we can go above that. There's been several series now which have had female sort of main characters. Now, so we've got Jessica Jones, we've got Supergirl, who's also been discussed. Interestingly enough, we have Supergirl, and she has her boss as a woman. She's obviously got her sister, and then she's got the two psychics who are kind of guys. So actually, again, we have a fairly even team between secondary male and female characters. And then we have Agent Carter.
Which I haven't watched yet.
Oh, I highly recommend it. It's
well, I've got it. I was given it for Christmas, but we haven't got around to watching it yet, so...
I really do enjoy it, and the whole point of Agent Carter is that she is definitely trying to strive in a male-dominated world. So she is surrounded by men who are mostly inept. Some of them are less inept, but mostly.
But it is World War II and post-World War II, so you would kind of expect that sort of
You kind of expect that in her line of work, but there are a lot of other female characters running around. So you've got those three, I think, are the main sort of female-led superhero things that are coming out at the moment. And now I'm going to mention one more, which is going to stand out because it's not live action, and that is Miraculous Ladybug and Chat Noir and Black Cat. Yeah, but it's he's called Chat Noir.
Yeah,
and it's a animation, and I believe it's Korean and French.
Okay, that's an interesting mix.
It's just an interesting mix. I believe in a previous episode we discussed the relationship between animation in the eastern parts of the world, so Japan, Korea, China, and in France. And animation is quite a big thing in France. And Miraculous Ladybug is actually a really good series. I watched a few episodes and thought meh, and then I went back to it and I actually really started to enjoy it. And it follows these two superheroes in Paris. One is a half Chinese, half Parisian girl, named Marinette, and the other is a young boy who's the son of a very famous designer called Adrien. And they go to school together. And the premise of the story is that they have these things called Miraculous, which grant them powers, and they're fighting a guy named Le Papillon, who in the English is called Hawk Moth because they couldn't call him Butterfly.
I was thinking
apparently it's not
Butterfly.
Sinister enough.
The villain's called Butterfly.
The villain is called Butterfly, but again, in French, it's Papillon.
In German, that must be brilliant because he'd be
Schmetterling.
Schmetterling.
But yeah, they decided no, we can't call him Butterfly in French. In English, no one will take him seriously, so they called him Hawk Moth, which I thought was a bit odd. But it's Papillon, and he. Their Miraculous give them, he's got a Miraculous as well, and each Miraculous gives them different sort of powers. And the Papillon has this power that he can give superpowers to other people. He can choose a champion, and he basically makes these, they're called Akumas, and he akumatizes people and makes them into supervillains for him in order to try and get Ladybug and Chat Noir's Miraculous. Now, the premise of the story is quite nice. Marinette, she's quite shy, she's a little bit clumsy. These tend to be qualities that we are quite stereotypical qualities. If we want to give a negative quality to a girl, we say, okay, she's going to be clumsy, because apparently being clumsy counts as a negative quality.
Yes, it's a flaw, but it's an easy flaw because people can identify with that, and it doesn't make her a nasty person. Whereas if you make someone a bit manipulative or give them a bad temper or something, that's a big flaw. And
the other thing is that being clumsy is kind of cute. You know, it's like, oh, she's a bit clumsy, which, I don't know, clumsiness as a flaw is always, I always feel it's quite lazy, unless they're really clumsy, but quite often it's, oh, they're a little bit clumsy, and you see them fall over, or, you know, get splashed a bit, and you're like, yeah, but if they were really clumsy, they'd be constantly covered in bruises, because they'd be walking into doors and stuff like that, and they never show that side of the clumsy. but all the constant the visits to the ER emergency services because, you know, he accidentally smashed a glass and got cut or anything like that. I mean, clumsiness is actually quite dangerous.
Don't try it at home, folks.
If you are clumsy, stop. This is coming from someone who's got very mild dyspraxia and the amount of times I see a door and I go, yes, I'm going to walk through that door, and I walk half through the door, but the other half of me just hits the frame, like, no perspective at all. I just straight into the door and just bruises everywhere.
That just really sucks.
Yeah, so that's clumsiness as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, back to Marinette. She's clumsy, she's a little bit stuttery, but she's quite outgoing, she's a nice person, she's very sweet. And she's head over heels in love with her classmate, Adrien. And Adrien is very quiet. He's very laid back. He's charming. He's quite sweet. He just seems to be a genuinely stellar guy and not very talkative or communicative. But he's definitely not cold. He's just kind of a little bit distant. Of course, they don't realize, but they are in fact both superheroes. And whilst they're Ladybug and Chat Noir, they're not allowed to reveal their identities, so they don't realize who the other one is. So Marinette is in love with Adrien, and Adrien, who's Chat Noir, is head over heels in love with Ladybug. And interestingly enough, and this is what I quite like, is that when they are active, when they are using their Miraculous, they kind of almost become the total opposite of themselves. Which is that Adrien, how would you say that? Adrien, I guess it is.
Yeah.
Adrien becomes very, he becomes the pun master for some reason. It's all puns about cats constantly, like seriously, stop it. He's very sort of flirtatious. He's very kind of energetic. He talks a lot. He's really sort of the opposite of this very cool, very collected guy that you see in school. And Marinette is incredibly confident. She has the quick retorts all the time. And I really, really like that, because these are traditional things that you apply to a female superhero, is that they need to be quick-witted, they need to be all of these things. But I quite like the idea that the reason she has the confidence to be able to be all these things is because she has a mask on.
Yes. Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually.
And that she's putting on this character. And I think that deals with something incredibly complicated, because she's not a different person. She's still absolutely the main person. But I think it deals with a real thing about identity, and a real thing about how we portray ourselves and how we understand ourselves as individuals.
Yeah.
And considering that it's a children's cartoon, and they're not doing it expressively, but I really, really like that. And I feel that she as a character, Ladybug, obviously she's the main character, is very real to me. She's definitely a superhero. She's probably a little bit too good at times, but she remains an incredibly real person, perhaps because there is that element of secretiveness about who she really is and how she portrays herself, and how she portrays herself in front of her friends, and how she portrays herself as a superhero.
Yeah. But doesn't that open up an interesting can of worms, in the sense of when she puts on a mask, she's almost more herself. She's herself plus 10.
But yeah,
she's
exactly.
She's able to do that as a female character because she's got the mask on, because she,
exactly.
She has expectations, as it were.
Yeah, and that's even more expressed by the way that Adrien acts, and the kind of explanation we get for why he acts as he does in Chat Noir is because that he lives an incredibly secluded life. He's only just been able to actually be able to allow to go to school. His father's uber protective of him, and he's been a shut in to his house, into this mansion, for his whole life. And he's constantly under surveillance, and he's constantly being watched, and he's constantly expected to be perfect. And so the moment he gets the mask, he's actually allowed to be himself. And I think that's absolutely the same with Ladybug, with Marinette, because she's not restrained in the same way that she is, but she's restrained almost by her own femininity. She's restrained by how she's supposed to behave in school, you know, how she's supposed to act. And that's obvious by how she can act when she has the mask on and she's being a superhero, by how she can act when she's not, when she's trying to just be an ordinary person.
Picking another thing off the list, that people would like to see, apparently, more disabled female characters where the disability isn't the main part of the story, it's just part of them.
Yes.
Because I haven't, in fairness, I haven't actually seen an awful lot of that.
No, this is true. We don't see a disability in a lot of female characters. Now, there are a couple of very good examples of that, and that is Avatar The Last Airbender and the Legend of Korra, the Avatar series. I don't know if you ever saw those.
Nope. Pass me by.
Again, absolutely, highly recommend. Very, very good. And there were several characters there with disability. And not only were they characters with disability, they were also often characters of colour or women of colour.
Yeah.
And that included Toph, who was blind. And then we had Korra herself at one point was quite badly hurt and was suffering from the equivalent of PTSD. And there were several villains one villain who didn't actually have any arms. And the way that they incorporated them into the story is that this did not stop them in any way. And this wasn't a main part of who they were. But it's not, again, it's not that common. It's not something that you see a lot of in books. But now that, here's a point, actually, because you, Jules, your main character is actually disabled as well, Emmeline.
Yeah, and I didn't actually deliberately set out to write a character who was in any way disabled. It was just a case of her backstory had affected her, and she ended up, because of the accident she was in, she ended up brain damaged, unable to read, and with an appallingly bad stutter, which means that her internal narrative is quite fluid and she has quite a vocabulary, but she has great difficulty getting any of that out so that anyone understands what she's saying. And she gets looked at like she's stupid a lot of the time.
Yeah, subsequence of that is that I would consider that she seems to have quite a large social anxiety.
Yes, she's socially quite uncomfortable in general, because it's not that she's shy, it's more that she's absorbed in the things that she's interested in, which is a big flaw for her, is the fact
because she struggles to communicate with people, and because she struggles to sort of make herself understood, and she doesn't really want to be seen, she does avoid social, you know, situations, and she doesn't have the confidence to go to school, for instance, and stuff like that.
No.
Yeah, she's given up on a lot of things, and this is a consequence of her disability. But again, her disability, you didn't come at the angle of saying, right, I'm going to write a person with disability. It was this character has disability, which is one part of who she is, which is actually another reason I really enjoyed the book, was because of the way that you wrote her disability, and it was very sensitive, but it was very plain, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing on writing book two, was do I now make it a lot easier for her? Because she does regain a certain amount of ability to read, mm-hmm. and she's never really facile with it. And that's part of the tragedy for her, was it was something she really loved doing before, and it was taken away from her. And should I make it easier for her to communicate? And I decided in the end that would actually be kind of cheap. I'd be letting people down if I did that. So she still has problems with her speech, and the more emotional a situation is, the harder it is for her to communicate. What I did do was, as a consequence of how things turn out in the book, and I won't say, because, you know, it'd be kind of nice if people wanted to read it. What I did do was, as a consequence of how things happened, she had more confidence to go in and tackle things despite having this disability.
Yeah. But it is, I like that, because it is a disability. And it was also the fact that the disability isn't going to stop her. And that there is an element of a social aspect to it, a social anxiety, which is when things do get more emotional, when things get harder, it gets even harder for her to communicate, which is something that is not often reflected in literature, but is very real in life.
And it is something that you would find more in a female character, unfortunately. I mean, you'd find it perhaps in some teenage boy characters as well, I think. But the having your voice taken away.
But this, and it's having the voice taken away, but there's something else, which is that your book is unique in that she's obviously the main character. She's had her voice, she's literally had her voice taken away from her, and she's had her outlet taken away from her, and because of that she's lost a lot of confidence. But she is an incredibly brave character, and she's not a passive character by any means. And I think quite often what happens is that we incorporate the same qualities into the same thing, which is that if someone has had their voice taken away from them, if they are that kind of person, they tend to be quite a shy person. They tend to be quite a docile person.
Yeah,
and that is absolutely not true of Emmeline in the least. And yeah, you've actually picked up on a reality.
Being inarticulate is not the same as having nothing to say.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the way that you show the frustration in that she absolutely does have something to say, and she absolutely wants to say it, but can't, and how frustrating that is something that a lot of people can relate to.
And it comes out, I suppose, most, and this, I'll just go on a little bit more because of it's more female characters. I have a very large female cast in my books.
Yes, you do, because you have the three sisters, and then the,
But this frustration and this anger comes out probably most with her older sister, Grace. And Grace is very articulate, very put together, very quick. She's whip smart with the wit. And it's almost torture for Emmeline to get anything out at all in response to Grace. And Grace takes advantage of that. It's horrible. I mean, there's reasons for the way Grace acts, but it's a very strained sister relationship compared to her relationship with her younger sister, which is a little bit easier.
And this, again, this is a nice thing, which is that very often we see the exploration of relationships between brothers in books and in literature. But I love the way that you write these three sisters, because you've got Grace, Emmeline, and is it Emmeline or Emmeline?
I say it both ways, so really it's whichever you prefer.
I'm going to stick with Emmeline then.
Yeah.
You've got Grace, you've got Emmeline, and you've got Amy. And they're three very different people, but they obviously all come from the same background. And yeah, Grace is not a very nice person, but she absolutely is not unjust in how she acts. She's a very real person, and when you get more into her head, you start to understand more of her motivation. And it's the same with Amy, that they're very distinct characters, and the relationship between the three is very real. And the cruelty of Grace taking advantage of Emmeline, which she does, she takes advantage of Emmeline's stutter, and she is able to hurt Emmeline in a way that no one else could.
Yeah.
She really knows how to sort of hit the mark in a way that only really siblings can do.
Yeah. They know your Achilles heel. They always do.
They always do. And she can really, really pick at it. Is so reflective, actually, of very often people with disabilities or people who are different or struggle to get something out. You often see them in literature getting bullied by other people, but actually the cruelest bullies are the ones close to home. And yeah. Emmeline suffers the most from Grace, and it's not to do anything to do with hatred. It's actually nothing really to do with hatred. It's to do with a lot of other complicated things.
There's a lot of sibling jealousy in there as well between.
Yeah.
Not so much with Amy, because there's enough of an age gap, but
yeah.
I think Grace and Emmeline are so close together that they're almost competing for the same place in the family, and then the family dynamic has been massively changed by the accident.
Yeah.
One thing I did enjoy was I've done a couple of novellas that fall mm-hmm. between books one and two, and it was really, really good fun to write something entirely from Grace's perspective. I didn't think it would be, but it was so much fun.
I actually really did enjoy, because I've read the beginning of that. I don't know how much you've changed it now. But actually, this is the mark. The mark of a good character in general is always whether, no matter who the character is in the story, they are the main character of their own story. Yeah. And they absolutely have their own voice. And Grace, I didn't expect it, but she's a fantastic main character.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind reading a lot of stuff from her point of view, because she's a fantastic main character. And I mean, this is okay, I'm being cheeky here. Amy is the younger sister, and Jules and I did a little bit of a fun thing a little while back where we decided to swap characters.
Yeah.
And we wrote a pair of really silly fan fictions where my character Rufus Merle ends up in Emmeline's backyard, essentially, and Emmeline's little sister Amy ends up in Hamartia. They get swapped, and so I got to write Amy, and Jules got to write Rufus. And I was writing Amy, and obviously I was communicating with Jules as I was writing Amy. And again, she's a fantastic character, and I really enjoyed writing from her, because I suddenly thought, what must it be like for Amy, who sees these two sisters who are very powerful? And you compare how she sees herself to how they see her, and how she sees them compared to how they see themselves. And that was very interesting to write. And again, a mark of a truly good character is the fact that they are all 100% three-dimensional people, yeah, onto themselves.
And you got it absolutely bang on the money. You really did.
Yes!
Because it was because I've also done a novella from Amy's perspective, which was a lot of fun to write. It was a lot lighter after having written the one that goes at the very end,
yeah,
which was Kieran's perspective, which has turned out to be quite dark.
Oh dear.
But Amy's was fun. It was quite light, and how she looks up and sees her sisters and how she sees herself in the whole dynamic. Yeah, you were bang on the money, so I must have got something across in the book, right?
You absolutely did. I mean, even though that she got very little screen time, as it were, her character came through very, very, yeah, well. So, yeah, that's an excellent example of not only good female characters, but female relationships with other characters. Very nicely done. We're coming to an end.
We are coming to an end. I'm just going to mention one more thing. This is, again, from the list. The list was really good. It was really comprehensive. I added a couple of things as well, but we can't go through every single item. They're saying they want more body types with girls, so more fat girls in fantasy genre fiction, for example.
Yeah.
And I think that's a reasonable request, really. I mean, they can't all be lean.
I agree. Also, it's not just fat and stuff like that and lean. It's also muscular. Like, where are all the muscular girls? You've got these warriors and they're sort of waving claymores around and stuff like that.
They're 90 pounds soaking wet.
Yeah, and you're just, they're like, but there's nothing to you.
Is that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, on the one element, like, this is... Hamartia cycle. I've got Luca, who's tiny, and she can wave a claymore around, as is proven. She's actually capable of cutting people in half, which we'll see later on. But that's because she's got the blood of Cullen in her veins, and she gets battle rage. Now, in the day to day, she's not that strong, but when she gets battle rage, she obviously kind of,
yeah,
she's got that. But for a character like Faye, she's always described as muscular. She's not a lean, but she's very strong. She's got a very powerful back. And again, this is another reason why I really like the legend of Cora, is that Cora, the main character, she's incredibly fit, but she's not thin. She's very muscular. She's got a very heavy build in that sense.
Yeah.
And I liked that. But I also agree that we do need to see other body types of varying degree, height and size and all sorts, other than just small and lean or tall and lean.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
And I think also strong should not be synonymous with able to wield a sword.
Yeah, this is true.
Just to slip that one in at the end. Doesn't mean they can't be, but that can't be the be all and end all of it. And I think that's where your characters work as well, because you've got Faye, who's a really good strategist as well. Luca, who really is quite, she's a very rounded character in her own right. She's very practical. I like the fact that she's practical as well, and she's a gifted musician, and there's lots to her. There's lots to both characters, so it's not a case of, yes, they're strong just because they're good in a fight, and yes, you would want them around. They are fully developed characters in their own right, and I think that's what it comes down to, is a strong female character should be just a strong character, who happens to be female.
Yeah, basically, yeah. A character who is onto themselves, you know, realistic. A human being.
Yes, someone who is complete in and of themselves as much as it is possible to be.
And it's all about how they're written rather than what they are, what they can do. And on that note,
this turned out to be a much more massive subject than I was anticipating. But
so I think we're going to have to return to it.
But just to be fair, we're at some point in the future, we will do exactly the same thing with male characters.
Yes, we are going to have a look at the portrayal of male characters and over masculinity and the emphasis.
Yeah, we are equal opportunities offenders.
Yes.
We will do both.
So we hope you've enjoyed. Don't forget that if you are enjoying our episodes and would like to see more of us, you can subscribe either via Podbean or via iTunes or Google Play, I believe, in the USA.
In the US, yeah, Google Play. Google Play, subscribing on there is coming to the UK at some point in the future.
So you can subscribe to us and get the episodes straight to your listening device of choice without any fuss at all. Or otherwise, you can listen to them or download them via Podbean direct.
And we'd love to hear from you if you have something to say.
And if you'd like to see us discuss something in particular, please do get in contact. Thanks very much.
Thank you, and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.